Today, in our second episode, looking back at a year since the first UK lockdown was announced, we hear from Shielders and their families to find out what the past 12 months has meant for people told not to leave their homes.
When the shielding system was announced, I think a week after that, I didn't hear anything from my GP. I didn't get a letter. I thought I'd be fine. And then the day after I thought I'd be fine, I got a text from my GP with a link to a letter to say that I needed to shield.
For Shamima Akhtar and the more than 2 million others who were considered most at risk during the first wave of COVID-19, being told to shield meant not leaving their homes at all. And in Shamima's case, that meant total isolation.
Yeah, it was difficult. I mean, I didn't know whether I was allowed to even leave my flat. So I live in a 21-storey building on the 8th floor, and it's a north-facing building with not a lot of sunlight. I just thought I'd be trapped like a little bird in a cage.
12 months on, and Shamima has barely been outside. And like many who have been shielding, she's had to navigate confusing support networks, patchy local services, and a vaccine rollout that has still left many of the most vulnerable without a first jab.
You know, I'm young. I was 25 when the pandemic hit, and I've lost my mid-20s. That's what it feels like.
Now shielding is due to end on the 1st of April, but many of those following the guidelines still aren't reassured it's safe to start leaving their homes just yet. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, a year inside. What lockdown has been like for the UK's most clinically vulnerable. Frances Ryan is a Guardian journalist who knows just how hard this year has been for shielders, because she's one of them. And she remembers very clearly the moment just over a year ago when she realised she was going to have to stay indoors.
Yeah, I remember it as quite sudden.
In a few days' time, by this coming weekend, it will be necessary to go further and to ensure that those with the most serious health conditions are largely shielded from contact, from social contact, for around 12 weeks.
I think for lots of us, you know, it wasn't a case of waiting for Boris Johnson to announce that we were locking down, making those decisions before it was official government policy. Because the reality was that Boris Johnson was, you know, slow in doing that, and we were having to make judgments about protecting our own safety, you know, before the government.
So you actually started shielding before Boris Johnson announced the lockdown a year ago today. What was that like for you?
You know, it was really surreal. It was, you know, such a sudden change. But I think you really quickly go into practicality mode. We're just working out the basics about, you know, literally survive this sort of thing by, you know, how am I going to get shopping in? How am I going to keep my job? How am I going to just live day to day? And it becomes, you know, this global pandemic actually sort of boils down to really mundane things like, you know, have I got food in for tonight's tea? Can I get a Tesco delivery when the whole of the rest of the country are clamouring for one?
Who was told to shield back in March?
So early on, there were sort of a range of conditions that the government put on their official shielding list. It was anything from people with chronic lung conditions, people who had low immunity, and people who, for example, had an organ transplant. So it was quite a limited list of people, but at the same time, it amounted to just over 2 million people. But it became apparent very quickly that there were lots of people with underlying health conditions who needed to shield but hadn't made this sort of official, very limited list of conditions.
Yeah, I remember lots of people were very worried because their condition was not being included on the official list. But they were still being advised by their GPs or specialists to act in line with the shielding guidelines. And those who were sent letters, I've found one online here that was sent out last March, and it says that you shouldn't leave the house at all, And if you live with people, avoid using the same bathroom. It was incredibly strict and in many cases, completely unrealistic. Was there any support available for people to help them to do this?
Shielders were eligible for support with sort of practical things like food deliveries and making sure that you had your medicine delivered to the house. We know that that helped a number of people, but also if you didn't make the official shielding list, you weren't eligible for that support. So there was definitely a case of many, many people sort of falling through the cracks of that support system. I think there just wasn't enough recognition from the government that many shielders were working age. So they had, you know, a career to maintain, they had children to get to school. We heard Boris Johnson repeatedly refer to the elderly when he talked about shielding. And there was a real sort of failure, I think, from the government to recognise that a significant number of shielders were, you know, they were in their 20s and 30s.
So my name is Shamima Akhtar. I'm a 26-year-old. I am a visually impaired person. I have mental health difficulties, fibromyalgia, an asthmatic, and a lot of allergies.
A lot of allergies.
I am genuinely allergic to the world.
Really?
It's dust mites, milk, wheat, grass, cats, and dogs.
Oh, no, yeah. All the good stuff.
Yeah, all the good stuff. I'm a big cats fan, and I might not become a cat lady in the future.
Initially, Shamima, you weren't told to shield, and then you did get a letter from your GP saying that you should. Did you feel like you were given the support you needed to do this?
I mean, from the perspective of the government support, no. I was receiving the food parcels from, I think, around maybe April to July is when they stopped. The food parcels weren't adequate. I am allergic to milk and gluten. I had to rely on a mutual aid group that was set up. And they were delivering meals and they were actually able to cater for dietary needs. You know, I was worried about financially how I was going to cope because I didn't have a job at that point. I just didn't know how I was going to cope, really.
The lockdown in March had a huge impact on the clinically vulnerable living at home, like Shamima, but also on those living away from their families in full-time care.
I'm John Gillibrand. I'm the Vicar of Pont Adelais and Penllegar, an Anglican priest in the Diocese of Swansea and Brecon.
This is John. His son Adam has autism and learning disabilities, and he lives in residential care.
Adam is a young man in his 20s now. He's coming up to 28. He is deeply, deeply loved by his family and his friends. Until you've listened to Adam on one of his joyful moments, enjoying himself, you haven't quite got what joy is about. It keeps me going, I'll tell you, day by day. Although we're enjoying our conversation now, I've never had a real conversation with Adam. He's almost without language. We occasionally hear a few words he's able to express, certain likes and dislikes in language, but he's largely nonverbal. We have never been sure whether he recognises us or not. So it's a question, I think, of being present to him, of being with him, of being alongside him.
Well, when the pandemic really reached this country, a year ago now, and we went into lockdown last March, how did that affect how you could see your son?
We've only seen him a couple of times since the beginning of the pandemic, and that in itself has been a break to his routine and ours. And as you know, being on the autistic spectrum, his routine is important to him. Now that he's in his 20s and in this residential setting, one of the great things is that there is a great effort made to take him out and about in the community. That's important both to Adam and I do believe to the local community. And so much of that has had to be put on hold.
Has Adam been shielding this past year?
Technically, no. But the truth is that in all practical terms, he has been shielding. So, yes, in reality, shielding, but legally and technically not. Funny old world.
John doesn't know why Adam wasn't included on the shielding list, but the consequences of this weren't to become apparent until much later on. In the summer, as the country began to reopen, people who were officially on the shielding list, like Shamima and Francis, were told that they could start going outside again.
But there's one group who've been more patient and given up more than almost any other, and that's the 2.2 million people who've been shielding in England.
So first, from July the 6th, we're advising that people who are shielding may want to start meeting in groups of up to six people outdoors, including those outside their household.
A few weeks later, on the 1st of August, all shielding was paused. But that didn't mean that everyone who had been shielding now felt safe enough to leave their homes.
I remember there being a lot of concern at that time, at the ending of shielding. It was a moment when actually infection rates were still incredibly high. And we were in a situation, I think, as high-risk people, we were reading the news telling us that coronavirus was still raging in the community.
The Prime Minister has postponed a further easing of coronavirus restrictions in England, which were due to take effect tomorrow because of a rise in the number of new infections. And in another sign of the government's concern, Boris Johnson announced that the compulsory wearing of face coverings would be extended to cinemas, museums, galleries and places of worship from August the 8th. Figures from the Office for National Statistics indicate that there are around 4,200 new cases of the virus a day in England, up 50% on last week's estimate of 2,800.
But at the same time, the government were very suddenly telling us actually clinically extremely vulnerable people were somehow now safe to go outside. So this really led to a situation where many shielders actually continued to stay inside their homes, but the government had officially ended the shielding programme. And that meant that shielders were no longer eligible for the support that they previously were, such as social security benefits, if they were unable to work from home, food and medicine deliveries. So in practice, it wasn't really shielding that stopped in August, but it was practical support for shielders. And I think the other issue was the real lack of communication around shielding. And there were so many moments, I think, over that year, particularly in August, where shielders felt that they just didn't know what was happening. They were told by the government to suddenly either go out or stay in overnight. They often ended up reading it in a leak on Twitter the night before. And I think that really created a sense of doubt and confusion and added anxiety for a lot of shielders.
After July, what I started doing was I started just rationing the amount of food I was eating. I wasn't eating a lot of food because the mutual aid groups also had to stop because everyone had to return to work and there wasn't enough people to kind of do distribution or, you know, actually cook the food because they'd cook it fresh and deliver it. So, yeah, it was really difficult, especially in the summer, because that was the time when lots of people were going out and having fun. You know, eat out to help out was a huge thing. I couldn't really take part in that. It was just really depressing. And I think from then on, I noticed that I started to become really depressed because of the situation. You know, the government was saying that they were providing lots of help. They weren't providing lots of help. And yeah, I didn't know what to do.
I'm really shocked that you've used the word rationing there, Shamima. Were there points where you were going hungry?
Yeah, it was a really difficult time.
So you were being told you could go outside, and you did a bit, but you knew the virus hadn't gone away. How worried have you actually been about getting COVID this past year?
Immensely. Two-thirds of COVID deaths were disabled people. People with learning disabilities were up to 6.3 times more likely to die of the virus than people without. Those statistics were really scary. I had no idea if I got it, how much worse it would be. Would I just get long COVID? Would I be hospitalised? Would I die? We were being told to wear masks to stop the spread of it, but I couldn't wear a mask because I'd recently had no surgery, and I wouldn't be able to breathe properly with a mask. I was very, very worried about getting the virus and potential impact, because I knew that I'd been identified as someone that needed to shield, and my risk of dying or going on a ventilator wasn't going to suddenly decrease because, there was some arbitrary system that might decide that I'm less vulnerable or not.
Over the past 6 months, we've been in and out of varying degrees of lockdown and tier systems, and shielding was reintroduced in November. In February, an extra 1.7 million people were added to that shielding list. But throughout this entire period, as the rules have changed, as the levels of support have changed, you've pretty much remained indoors, shielding by yourself for a year. How have you felt doing that?
Isolated, lonely. I found myself just talking to myself, talking to myself in the mirror, talking to myself in the shower. I don't know if I'm trying to give myself some sort of company. I don't think I've hugged anyone for, well over a year, and I just haven't had anyone come near me in a meaningful way. And I think that's part of what's impacted my mental health, not being able to, have that kind of connection with anyone.
Do you think that you've had to develop coping mechanisms to kind of get by, or has this got harder?
So, I think I'm out the other end of going through a really, really, really dreadful place. So just before the Christmas break, I was at crisis point. It really hit me that I was going to be by myself, that I wasn't going to be able to see my family, wasn't going to be able to see my friends. I wasn't coping at that point at all. I wasn't coping. And I was honest with my friends about how I was feeling and how I was quite scared about how I was feeling. And they kind of dropped everything and they said, I need to come and stay with them, whatever the risk is.
It sounds like you've got some really good friends.
They were amazing. Absolutely. They've been amazing.
Yeah.
And I think I'm out the other side, and I'm back at my, just feeling anxious about the fact that I'm shielding and by myself again. So there's progress, but I feel like I'm back at square one.
I think there's a sort of a sense of a cumulative impact over time. It's really difficult to be told to stay in your home effectively 24/7 for a few months. But it becomes even harder, of course, when that's off and on for over a year now. There's been, I think, a lack of awareness or a lack of recognition of what that does to people's mental and physical health, and certainly a lack of support for the millions of people going through this. And of course, all of this has been happening whilst many people lost the support of disability services as day centres and respite centres closed through lockdown, and social care was pulled or rolled back. So I think there's been a real sense of though many people had some support in place, there's been a real sense of others being let down at this time and being left to survive this incredibly difficult period by themselves.
Frances, this isn't just about how supported disabled people have felt, but also how safe they've actually been. Shamima referred to the fact that almost two-thirds of people who've died from COVID in the UK had a disability. Why is this?
So some opportunity vulnerable to COVID and therefore sadly more likely to pass away. But I think it's really important to emphasise there's also issues like poverty and housing. Disabled people are more likely to live in poverty than other people, to live in poor housing conditions. You know, there's an assumption, I think, when a disabled person dies of COVID, that this was somehow an inevitable death. These are not inevitable deaths. A disabled life is worth just as much as anyone else's, and they had just as much chance of surviving in many cases. It points to deep, systematic inequalities facing disabled people in the UK. I think that's a hugely important thing for all of us to consider, that these people had every right and every chance to survive.
Something that really shocked me were reports that people with learning disabilities were being told that they would not be resuscitated if they got ill with COVID-19. What did you make of that?
DLRs, you know, have a place in dignified end-of-life care. But the issue is that these were reportedly being used in a blanket way, so because of disability rather than individual need, and also without consultation.
Sonia De Leon, so into her family, was defined by much more than her schizophrenia and learning disabilities.
Sonia had an absolute zest for life, loved being with her family, you know, always smiling, always laughing.
Sonia has got the moves. She's got the moves.
But when the 58-year-old went to hospital last April, her lifelong conditions influenced her care. Initially admitted with a fever and respiratory problems, she tested positive for COVID, and a do not resuscitate order was placed in her medical notes.
I think, you know, this goes to the very heart of cultural prejudice about a disability that still exists. This presumption that because someone needs help with personal care, for example, that their quality of life is worth less than someone else.
Last week, the Care Quality Commission, which regulates healthcare in England, released a report which found that in over 500 cases where do not resuscitate orders were made, many for disabled people, they were not discussed with the individual or their family, potentially breaching their human rights. The NHS have said that decisions like these should be made in consultation with families, and that blanket do not resuscitate decisions are unacceptable. Coming up, after a year spent shielding, how some people with disabilities still weren't prioritised for a vaccine. Francis, the vaccine rollout began at the end of last year. What did that mean for disabled people and shielders in general?
I think in some ways the vaccine rollout has made this lockdown easier because shielders have had hope that there's some sort of reprieve on the horizon. But at the same time, the way the government and the independent body has run the vaccine rollout, so primarily putting the focus on old age rather than younger people with severe disabilities, has created added anxiety for people. You know, there's people who have not made the initial official shielding list, but were effectively shielding all year, who haven't made the grade for early vaccination. And that has been, you know, deeply psychologically wounding for those people to have sacrificed so much over the past year and have still been excluded from early vaccination.
The issue of some disabled people not being prioritised for vaccines came to the public's attention a few weeks ago when the BBC presenter Jo Wiley spoke of her anger at being offered the vaccine before her sister Frances, who has a rare genetic syndrome and lives in residential care.
I've been asking for her, wanting for her to have her vaccine for a year, to be honest with you, to be protected. And then for me to suddenly get a call to say that I've got the vaccine, it just felt hideously unfair. Andrew, she actually was called in for her vaccine last night. My mum got a message to say that she could get vaccinated, but it's too late. She's fighting for her life in hospital. I mean, it couldn't be crueler. It just couldn't be crueler.
As a result, the Joint Committee on Vaccination advised the government that everyone on the GP Learning Disability Register should be prioritised for a vaccine. It meant 150,000 more people were offered the jab. John, you spoke earlier about how your son Adam was not on the shielding list. This didn't immediately have an impact on him, but when the vaccine rollout started, that changed. You realised that this meant he would be in a lower priority group for the jab, which actually delayed him getting it. He's finally had his first dose, which must be a relief for you, because we know that people with learning disabilities are much more likely to die if they get COVID than the general population.
Yes, people with learning disabilities in Adam's age group, the figure is, I think, 30 times more likely. So a huge relief. As a minister of religion, I'm into the business of resilience and of holding with and bearing with anxiety. But it was over the weeks a real daily anxiety, particularly should we get that phone call which said that he'd developed symptoms of COVID. And thank God that call didn't come.
Are you angry, John, that Adam was not on that shielding list and therefore was not a priority for a vaccine?
I go back to Adam's diagnosis there back in 1997. I've been angry ever since, not angry about Adam's situation, but angry about the way in which, as parents and carers, we're constantly having to raise our voice to secure things that should be happening anyway. Adam does not have a voice of his own, literally does not have a voice of his own, and does not have legal capacity. And I regard myself as having a moral duty then to speak on his behalf, and will do as long as I can draw breath. We have to listen as a society to each other's voices, and that duty includes disabled people and learning disabled people.
Francis, it's been a very long year, but especially for you and others who have been shielding officially or otherwise this whole time. How are you feeling about it now?
I think shielding, of course, has been difficult for everyone. You know, I found it, you know, incredibly challenging at times, but like so many aspects of the pandemic, I think it's, you know, it really shows up the impact of inequality. I've been really lucky because I've been able to work from home safely without losing my job. I've had money in the bank to pay for, you know, food deliveries. And lots of people haven't had that. And I think the pandemic, and particularly shielding, has really shown up that actually, you know, society isn't fair. People who have more money and better health are able to protect themselves in times of crisis. And people who have poor health and lack of financial means are not. And I think the shielding has really shown up how people with disabilities and people in poverty, and those two groups cross over, as well as those in sort of ethnic minority, marginalised communities, are the ones to suffer greatly during times of crisis. And they're the ones who governments need to protect. And yet again, we've seen, I think, the real failure of a Conservative government to ease that inequality. The pandemic has simply, you know, replicated and entrenched inequalities that we've seen grow over the last decade. And I think how much shielders have had to take over the past year, how disabled people have struggled, has really just demonstrated more clearly than ever that the people in this country who have health problems, people who have disabilities, people who need more support, are often very much forgotten.
Do you ever think about what life is going to be like when restrictions lift? You know, what are you looking forward to?
The thing is, it's a different relationship, as I'm sure you've gathered from what I've been saying. But that doesn't mean to say that we don't, when we go and see him, we don't give him a hug. We don't give him a hug. And that we have missed all of that opportunity for physical contact. And there's a lovely family photo of the four of us sitting in a row on a sofa in his previous residential placement. And just to be able to do that again, to have a family picture and to sit in a row together, would be, it'd be really nice.
I just want to be able to see people and have a social experience with them, whether that's eating out or going dancing, or having a hug. I just want to be able to see people. I want to be able to see my family. I want to be able to see my little sister, who's 13, and I want to be able to hug her.
I really hope that can all happen for you as soon as it can, Shamima. And thank you so much for speaking to me and telling us about what's happened to you this year. I really appreciate it. Thank you. That was Shamima Akhtar. Thank you to her and to John Gillibrand for sharing Adam's story. Francis Ryan has been reporting on the impact the pandemic has had on disabled people for the past year, and I really recommend going back through her articles. You can find them at theguardian.com. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Joshua Kelly and Rhys Storer. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.